can sit here and watch as it all falls away into winter and pretend I'm surprised by the darkling skies and the rain. Or I can sit here and wait for death to come upon me like a stranger. I can sit here all night, the fog rolling in and getting thicker. Welcome to Music is the Drug, the Cowboy Junkies podcast. I'm Dave Bowler, and I wrote the biography of Cowboy Junkies, Music is the Drug. We've got a very special podcast for you today. On June the 2nd, Cowboy Junkies released their new album, Such Ferocious Beauty. It's an album of 10 songs that, if you ask me, is up there with anything that they've done right across their career. To celebrate its release, we've got a two-part conversation with Michael Timmins, all about the thinking behind the record, its themes, its recording process, and its songs. Added to that, there's plenty of music, both from the record itself, the songwriting and early production demos, and there's even a demo of a so far unreleased track sprinkled in there too. To start with, I asked Mike what his perspective on the album was now that it's about to be released.
You do so many, release so many records and you think you'd remember from record to record, but I can never remember how I feel about releasing records, but I think it's always the same. It's sort of like I have no idea, you know, if it's any good or bad. I mean, because you've been in it for so long, you know, working a record, and then it gets to a point where you finish it, and then there's a huge delay releasing it. So by the time it comes to release it, it's like, what is this record? Like, is it any good? Should we just can the whole thing? Stop playing music?
When did the itch to start writing this one appear?
It would have been coming out of COVID, sort of not totally out of it, but kind of you know, the there was a little bit of a light at the end of the tunnel. And during COVID, I'd done you know, my improvisation record, and I'd done Townies with Andy, and those were really two very inspiring projects. So, and you know, because writing is a solitary, you know, we're still under COVID protocols, but writing's a solitary thing. So, I think I went late in the summer. I did a little foray into, I went up north and did a little, you know, for a few days just to see if there's anything there. Cause I was inspired by those projects. And so I wanted to keep that going and started to write a bit, got a little, you know, moved it forward a little bit, and then kind of again in the fall, went up again somewhere else and did a bit more writing. And that was good for about, you know, maybe 10 days or so. And then in the spring, I really sort of kicked it into high gear and had this thought of going up to where near where Margaret lives. She lives about 2 hours north of Toronto. So I rented a couple of different places up there near her, about 30 minutes away from her, and began to write with the idea that as I was writing, Margaret would show up, you know, in the afternoons, and we'd sort of work on songs, you know, just the two of us, which is kind of an old way, but a new way for in the last couple of decades for us to do it. And so that was kind of fun. And it really started to roll then. So like in March of 2021, I guess, March to June of 2021, it really sort of took shape and we did a lot of writing and it sort of kind of finished the whole thing off as far as the writing was concerned. And then began to record in the summer, I think, with the band. And Al was also feeding me some stuff at that point too, some music. And so I was beginning to work on those from a lyrical and melody point of view. And so it all began to really snowball. Really the spring of 21 is when it really sort of began to take shape.
We've talked before on many other records about having to make the space to write. You sort of mentioned a bit of it there. Where did you get away to?
Well, I found a great place, which I did a lot of it at, this barn near Margaret. It's called Eugenia Falls. And it was this amazing barn that had been converted into a living space. So it was this huge, huge space. And it sounded great in there. Just, you know, me playing my guitar and singing to myself sounded really good. Sort of like singing in the shower in a way, but a big, big, huge shower. And so that was really fun and beautiful. I had these big, huge windows that looked out onto this open field and lots of places for me to go fishing and for me to go hiking and just get out of my own head or into my head, one or the other. And so it was a great spot. That was the main spot where I did most of it, and where Margot sort of began to get into the project as well.
I mean, we'll come back to that a bit more later on, but I mean, that's one of the things that's really struck me about the record. It seems a very bandy kind of record, you know. I mean, it's very much that everybody was really heavily involved in it, very heavily into it.
Yeah, it was interesting, you know. I mean, some records are very much pieced together, and some records are in the studio, and we all kind of, you know, work on them as a band. This one, in many ways, it was worked on really hard by everybody, but in sort of separately in a weird way. Like, as I say, Margot and I, you know, did a lot of the pre-production, basically. We just, every one of these songs was worked out with me and Margot, just on acoustic guitar and Margot. And that's how it started. And then, you know, Al started to feed ideas, so that those songs then began to take shape or go in a different direction. And Al and I then worked really closely. And then me, Al, and Pete got together and started to work in the studio. And Pete began to add some drum ideas, which again changed some of the songs again in a whole other direction. And then and Margot at this point was pretty conversant with these songs because we'd been working with them. So she came in and, you know, adding the voice and adding her in there, you know, kind of changed them again. And then they really changed a lot in the which doesn't necessarily always happen with us in the post-production, like in the mixing side of it. That was the most laborious and difficult part. There was lots of ideas in there that Al and I had added and Pete had added, and musically. So there's a lot of editing to be done from what we had recorded. So I did a lot of that initially. And then, so I went through all the songs and sort of did an initial edit and sort of got arrangements going. And then Al and I did a second run through and tried to do some final mixing of the songs. We were happy with them, but we weren't ecstatic about them. And at that point I sort of, you know, I'd been sitting with these songs from writing to recording, to mixing and arranging for over a year at that point. So I was really burnt out by them. And so I thought we should get, you know, try and get a fresh ear in on them. And so we called up Joby Baker, who we'd collaborated with really successfully on At the End of Past Taken and a couple of the Nomad albums. And so I called Joby up, and he was really excited to get involved. So I sent them out. I sent these the sort of the arranged tracks out to Joby, and the good thing is that Al lives nearby Joby. So Joby did some initial mixing, and then Al went in and kind of finalized stuff and would send stuff to me and just to give a final ear to. And that really took off. It took a little bit of time for Joby to get into the groove of it, but once he got it, he really got it. And that was sort of the final touch. So it was kind of a weird, these songs took a really strange route, you know, from me and my guitar and Margot singing them as folk songs all the way through the process of recording and Al adding ideas and Pete, and then finally going to somebody totally outside the band to do the final touches on the mixes. So it was quite a process. And, you know, albums can get lost like that sometimes. Sometimes they can be improved. Like, I think Paths Taken is a similar record that had a similar-ish type route, where it was a complicated process, but it ended up being really great. So at this point, I can't judge this record, but I was very happy where it ended up, and whether it's good or not, I don't know. But we finally achieved the sound we wanted to achieve, and that's all you can do when you're making a record.
That's an interesting point, the sound of it, because it does. I mean, obviously, you've been making records for 30 odd years. It's going to sound like you, but there is a different kind of texture to this record compared to some of the more recent ones. I think perhaps it's a bit more a bit more open, I think.
Well, that's interesting. I don't know. Like, I just wanted them to sound. I just wanted to be like there's so many, there's a lot of, on some of these songs are quite dense, right? So I want to make sure all those arrangements came through. And I also wanted the drums and the bass to really sound heavy. Like, I just wanted to really, like, just really anchor everything down, since there was so much, you know, added overdubs and keyboards and things and guitar, little guitar bits here and there. So I wanted to make sure that, you know, that all came through. And I think I always feel the way to do that is to just make sure you get a really strong foundation, which is their bass and drums. And that's what I think I was missing in the mixes that we initially did. And Joby was able to bring that out. He just has a really great way of bringing out bass and drums, since that's what he is. He's a bass player and a drummer. He's everything, but he's also a great bass player and drummer. So he understands those instruments. And then I think the openness just came from, that's probably Al and I, you know, pushing in a certain direction, you know, making sure that everything isn't too upfront and compressed, and just making sure that there's depth for all the instrumentation. But I'm glad it has a different sound. We definitely wanted to go for a different sound, and I'm just hoping that our personality comes through that sound. that's always my thing. You know, it's fine to go for a sound on a record, but you want to make sure that the band's personality comes through. And that's what I worry about sometimes when you go through a long process of making a record. But anyways, that's for other people to tell me. So.
We'll come on to the songs in a bit, but I think as individuals, I think this is some of the best playing that all four of you have ever done. I mean, some of Margot's best ever singing, I think. And then for the three of you, the way that you've played, I think it's some of the best that you've ever done.
Well, that's great. That's nice to hear. I mean, you know, hopefully, you know, you get to a point where you're obviously professionally capable, but you want to continue to be inspired too as far as the playing goes. That's the important thing. I agree. Like, I think Margot's singing is fantastic on this. There's some amazing grooves that Pete came up with that attached to Al's playing. And, you know, Al does a ton on this, from bass playing to keyboards, which is really spectacular. And I'm happy with my playing too. So, I think all around it was kind of, there's a lot of inspiration involved with it. It was just a matter of putting it all, the inspiration of writing and recording, and then trying to find, you know, trying to make sure that all came through in the final mix, which was the final touch.
You co-produce it with Al. Did Al come to Toronto and spend a chunk of time there while you were doing that, or was it, how does that work?
A combination, you know, so it's him, I mean, his production ideas start at the minute he sends me some musical ideas, because some of the songs are very much what he sent me, I didn't even touch as far as writing. I wrote what he sent, right? So he sent me some pretty elaborate musical ideas, like a song like Flood and Hard to Build and Mike Tyson are all pretty much what he sent, you know, the basic structures and the music are, you know, his part, like the keyboards and bass, are pretty much what he sent me. I never touched them, so I wrote to those. So that's part of the production ideas, because he's basically doing some arranging there. And then the other side of the production is, you know, him being that second set of ears, when I'm mixing and when Joby's mixing, you know, really giving detailed feedback as to what's working, not working in a mix. And you know, that's producing, right? That's a big part of it. So, you know, it was like Past Taken was very similar, and that's why he's co-producing on that too, because it's a real, at this point in my life and my career, I really do need that in especially dealing with junkie stuff. I need somebody to really give me feedback and you know, honest, direct feedback, because, you know, I've written a lot of songs for this band and recorded a lot of music. So it's easier for me to get, you know, to second guess myself or think, well, we've done that before, so why do that again? Or I love this just because it's different, you know, rather than actually hearing it going, is this good or bad? You know, like, you know, it basically comes down to that. Is this any good? So, and it's oddly enough, it can become hard to hear that in your own music after a while, because you have so much baggage, I guess, with it, you know? So that's a big, big part of what he does. He always has, but especially on these records, especially, he's really important on them.
all my favourite records have got those little human bits of, you know, talking before a song, or, you know, you can hear people putting their instruments down, that kind of thing. I mean, obviously, in most cases, that gets polished out of records, but you chose to keep it in with that, and I think that's a really nice touch.
Yeah, and that was part of trying to keep the personality in the record too. As I say, I was a little afraid of losing some of the human element of this, and I wanted to make sure that we were all there. And I think that is part of getting the listener into sort of remembering, oh yeah, right, these are people making the songs. You know, these are four humans making this noise. So I do like adding in, or not even adding in, but just keeping in, like, yeah, sounds before and after an album, a song. And even on this song, on this recording, there's two songs where there's stuff that was going on while we were recording that I kept in. And that's, that, you know, because Margot and I were recording some of these songs we used from the recordings that Margot and I did at the barn. So the bird songs and the songs of frogs, and that was all part of that process, right? Just having the windows open and letting the natural world come in, because it was such, you know, it was springtime and it was beautiful and COVID was over. So we included all that.
What were the sort of the themes that you were looking to write about when you first got back in it?
It's hard, you know, again, it's the process is so long and you sort of forget. I mean, I do think when I was writing this record, it was inspired by, as I say, coming out of COVID. So there was sort of that whole year-ish of sitting around sort of reassessing. And then, you know, a lot of it was at the same time as that was happening, our father was getting worse and, you know, getting his dementia was getting worse, and he was getting more sort of, to his final several months of life. He didn't necessarily know that, but he was definitely in a bad way. So there was that, you know, his decline basically. And then, you know, I think just at the same time there was, if you think about it, this is August, starting in the fall of 2020. So, you know, there was all that continued craziness in the U.S. and in our world, that fed into it. So I think all those things, I do remember thinking about that when I started in the writing project and thinking about, okay, well, these are all things that are happening that I want to somehow touch on, whether they remain in songs or not, I don't know, but I think they did. And so that was really it. And, you know, and what it really came down to, you know, when I was sort of halfway through writing this, you know, going up every month to my seclusion, you know, Patty, my wife, said, so, you know, what are you writing about? Very blunt question. And I said to her, you know, I said, well, I think, yeah, I said, I think you probably know what I'm writing about. And because it was pretty obvious that, you know, we and the whole world was going through the same thing. And she used the word, she said, impermanence. And I said, yeah, that's exactly it. Like that's what I'm writing about. I'm writing about impermanence and impermanence in all the different aspects of that word, you know, physically, conceptually, and, having to do with the systems we live under, having to do with people around us, having to do with one's state of mind and one's, the way one looks at the world. And so, you know, I think that is the word that sums up this album. And I think, so I think it's in many ways that I started with that basic idea. And I think the end album ended up there as well.
Just the last one, at sort of the generality. I mean, you're writing for vinyl again, not CD. I mean, we've mentioned this in terms of one or two of the songs and stuff in the past from other records. But I mean, that clearly does make a difference, I think.
Yeah, I think so. I don't feel the necessity, and you know, I mean, the only difference to me for writing for vinyl than for CD is quantity, right? Like in the 90s when CDs were coming on strong, that's all you had. You know, there was this idea that, you know, you weren't putting 10 songs, you had to aim for 12, which means you had to write 16, 18 songs. Now, you know, you can get away with 8 to 10 songs. So as long as you can get 13 or 14 good ones, you're good. So, but I don't necessarily work that way. I assume it has to be there in my mind. You know, was I'm sure I do at one point sort of sit down and add up. Okay, how many songs do I have here? Oh, that's okay. That's good. I need two more. But generally it comes into more like, do I want to write any more songs? Do I have any more songs to write? And I usually find that I get to a point where it's like, I'm done. Like I, you know, this last song I wrote is pure bullshit. You know, I'm obviously just writing now to write. Once I'm in a writing mode, I can write forever, right? Like I could continue to write it just nonsense. Because I'm in that mode and my brain's working that way and I'm in that rhythm, but I have to sort of at one point realize, okay, well, I'm going off the track now. Like, there's no point in writing more songs now, so I put it away, and then we start to head towards the recording side of it and shaping the songs and editing songs and getting rid of songs.
Maybe it's your heart. Circling like a storm. Maybe it's your heart. Whirling like a swallow, stitching up the sky.
I think, you know, that point about the length of the vinyl compared to CD is so important, because, you know, this record, it doesn't outstay its welcome. It lasts exactly as long as it should, and you can be engaged in it from first song to last song without feeling exhausted, without your ears aching, and, you know, and I think that makes a big difference.
Well, I agree, I'm glad you say that. Like, I really feel so strongly about that you have to, you can't exhaust the listener, and especially, as I say, this record is pretty dense, so it takes a lot of engagement. The listener has to engage with it, you know, it takes a lot of energy and a lot of attention, you know, a lot of your brain width to deal with it, to properly get into it. So if you're going to ask a listener to do that, you can't ask them to do it for an hour and a half. You know, I mean, if you can keep it close to 40 minutes, well, that's doable, I think, for most brains still. And I don't know for how much longer, but right now I think it's fine. I think we can handle 40 minutes of paying attention to one thing.
So the songs. What a Lost, obviously we've done a chunk about that, but in the context of the record and listening to it as part of the album, it's a very strong opening statement, isn't it?
Yeah, you know, getting back to the idea of impermanence, it's probably the most literal, you know, response to impermanence. It's about my dad and his dementia and his losing of his memories and his of his life, basically still being alive, but losing his life, and then it's also, in turn, it's the idea of, you know, those people around you or around the one who's going through this, losing that attachment too, losing the person who you've grown up with, and, you know, your father, who you've identified as your father, is suddenly not there. It's really strange. You know, the body's there, but the person's not there. And so it's all about that to me. What I, and, you know, what I lost is basically that's it's impermanence. That's what it's about. So it was very important to have that as the first song. It sort of sets up the tone of the lyrically, certainly the tone of the album. And also it's a nice way. It's relatively unencumbered. There's some overdubs to it, but it's pretty open. You know, it's mainly the four of us sort of sitting on a groove and playing, which is kind of a nice way to introduce it too. And I think Margot's vocal on it's fantastic too. So.
You said when we talked about it last time that sitting with your dad through that period kind of made you reevaluate what reality is. I mean, I think that's what that period does, because, you know, I had the same thing with my dad, not through dementia, but he was on lots of morphine and stuff at the end, and it, you know, it does make you think, well, perhaps they're more real than we are. I don't know.
Yeah, well, totally. I had conversations with my dad that we were not in the same plane, you know, reality plane, but why was his any different? Why was his any more real than mine? You know, just because mine was larger, I guess, in that I could physically go into more places in mine. His was just as real to him, you know, and maybe he could go to more places than I could, because, you know, he was going through he's in a different dimension almost. And so it is interesting, you know. I really find it fascinating. It's I mean, the literally the space that he was sitting in was different than the space that I was sitting in, and we were sitting in the same room, like, you know, because he would talk about the room next door and, you know, the restaurant there and the person who lives there, and, you know, he's basically talking about his bedroom, but he's experiencing a completely different space and different people, you know, who are around us, and, you know, you know, I don't know why that. So it was totally real to him. So who am I to say that my space is more real? So it was very interesting. It was kind of fascinating in that way. Obviously terrifying, but you know, it was fascinating for sure.
I looked at the room and didn't know what to do. His hands at the keys and were brought to a rendezvous. The explosion of sound, and our minds are scattered round. The maestro pounds, and my spine takes hold of me, shakes me around, and that's when I break free. This is what I lost today.
It's interesting as well with that, and then, you know, you talk about the is interesting jazz, and, you know, that comes out in the week as well. And I guess in a way that's what jazz does.
Well, that's just interesting. That's true. That's true. I mean, certainly more modern jazz, it kind of explodes the idea of what's a melody and what's a scale and what's a hook. And for sure. That's interesting. That's funny.
Was that stuff, I mean, you must have heard a lot of that stuff when you were growing up as a kid.
Yeah, I mean, that's, you know, that's my first memories as of music and of what music can do, is my dad coming home and putting on, you know, big band jazz and just blasting it to the house. And there were six of us, right? And it would make us go insane, like just bouncing off the walls and dancing and running around. And it was really bizarre. And I really have the memory of that. And, you know, sort of like this fun 30 minutes of just, here's dad's home, and just going crazy to the music. So I think that was, for all of us, it's probably, you know, a real sort of introduction to music and what it can do and how it can make you feel and how it can sort of change your reality, you know, for half an hour to an hour. It's so, for sure.
Just the last time, I mean, you know, we spoke about this a little bit when it happened, but I mean, when you lost your dad, and I know it sounds just a stupid word at our age, but when you become an orphan, however old you are, something about the world shifts. I don't know quite what it is, but there's you're not a kid anymore. Even, you know, in your 50s or your 60s, but while your parents are there, you are still a child in some sense. And then all of a sudden, that's gone.
Well, I think this is true with most families, is that you never really lose your position in the family, you know, especially if there's with multiple kids or even with an only child, you know, you are who your parents perceive you to be, you know, and it's very hard to break away from that. I think that's, you know, what in our teens and 20s, that's what we try and do. We try and, you know, try and prove that we are not who you think we are. But you always, your parents always see you in a certain light. And I see that with my own kids, you know, like, you know, they're in their early 20s now, and I kind of still see them as kids, you know, and maybe that's because we are who we all, you know, you are who you are. You can dress it up as much as you like, but you kind of, you know, who you become in those those prime years, you know, those years as kids, as pre-teen years, that's who you are. But once your parents die, the only, you know, that's the last, that's gone. Like, you know, now you can be, you still have that, a certain association with your siblings, I suppose, but not as strong as it is with your parents. And so that is blown away, and all of a sudden you are kind of unhinged. It's like, okay, now I can be who I want to be, you know, oh, too late. I'll just remain who I was. I wish I could go to my mom or my dad and have a conversation that I could have with them and nobody else, you know. But it is a funny thing. You know, you fight all your life to break that mold, and the mold is finally broken, and you kind of like, oh, that's kind of sucks. I kind of liked it. I kind of liked having a certain stability of self, you know.
That kind of rootlessness. I mean, there's a sense of that in the next song, Flood. Watching the water rise, caught between the river and the rock face. Watching the water rise. Watching the water rise, that's kind of how life, very much the way life feels at the moment. And do you try and get on the roof out of the way, or do you go downstream with it?
Yeah, and that's the idea of that song. It's, you know, there's a couple of different character perspectives in there, and it's, you know, it's people looking to sort of, it's moments in people's lives just sort of taking stock, right, and going, okay, well, you know, what's my next move here? And that exactly is, it's do I just go with it, just let it flow, and just try and make the best of it, or do I run from it or get caught in it and you know, and try and fight it? And I think there is a point in one's life that, you know, I hope, probably not in everybody's life, but certainly in mine, where I sort of got to a point where it's like, well, I'm just going to go with it. You know, I'm just going to let it carry me and try and witness it, you know, try and recognize it and take advantage of it and take advantage of it in a positive way, in that I'll, you know, absorb it and not fight it so much, you know? So yeah, that's sort of the idea behind that song, you know, and a flood is something, you know, that if you've ever seen a flood or being at all involved with one, you know how impossible it is to fight it. You know, I mean, water is just, forget it. Like, you know, you're not gonna win against water. So you might as well just let it carry you and become part of it and go with it, you know. So that's the idea of that song.
Let the current carry me all through such ferocious beauty. Just let the water rise.
It's got a similar sentiment and feel to a lot of what was on Open, you know, being present, being part of it.
Yeah, I think so. I think that's sort of the battle for everybody who's trying to figure out how to, you know, to enjoy their life. And it's easier to say, it's easier to recognize or to intellectualize. It's harder to do, right? So that, yeah, I think that's one of our recurring theme in some of my writing, that is sort of always in there, that sort of idea of just trying to enjoy it, you know, just recognize it and enjoy it. It's very hard.
The album title comes from there, Such Ferocious Beauty. I mean, it's a great title for a record. I mean, I suppose life's always that, but when you get to the extreme moments, you know, death or illness or a flood or whatever it is, everything becomes heightened, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, Margot picked up on that phrase. She's, you know, she said that's such a great phrase, and you know, and sort of focused on it. That should be the album title, and I agree. It's sort of, yeah, especially as you get older and as you begin to lose parents, especially, or those around you, and more friends are dying, and there is such a ferociousness to it. You know, it is. And which intensifies the beauty of it, right? You begin to appreciate life all the more, because it's like, oh my God, like, you know, it's so short. How you know, it's kind of a trite thing to say, but it is so short, and for some people it's criminally short. So you begin to recognize how unforgiving it is, and in many ways, and but how beautiful it is. So I really like the title, and it sort of fits into the whole impermanence side of it. You know, that's what makes it. That's what makes it beautiful, is that impermanence and its ferociousness. You know, because it's so impermanent, it's just like here and gone.
And I mean, it makes a great album title, and it's a vision. It's a great album cover as well.
Oh, good. Yeah, Pete came up with that. So of course, so yeah, he initially gave that to me, and the image, and you know, because I gave him the title and sort of said, this is what I'm sort of thinking, you know, the songs are about, and I want to sort of express this. And he gave me that image. And at first I thought, I love the image, but I'm not sure it works. Like and then, you know, he kind of said, well, let's talk about it. so he did, he sort of, we let it sit for a bit, and then he came back to me and sort of explained his thinking about it. And it's like, oh, of course, you're right. This is, it's totally perfect. It's like, it's such a great just image, right? So, yeah, it worked great. That's good. That's guitar. that's me. That's me with too many pedals going all at once. Yeah. But yeah, I mean, so this song, like, you know, it's basically the same cycle every verse, right? It sort of repeats itself. And that was, I didn't touch that. Like that's what Al created. And so I just wrote to it, and then I added the guitars on top of that, sort of. My thought was, I want, like, it's very I love the incessantness of what Al created, and sort of the unstoppable feel of it. It just feels like it's going forward and it's going to stop it. But I also wanted something more unstructured and loose with it, because it's very structured, right? It's a very structured sort of idea. So the idea was to throw that electric guitar on top of it, and just sort of try and play as well. That sort of comes from the inspiration from my improv record. Just have something and just play to it, right? Don't worry too much about it. So the noise at the beginning was when I was setting up my sound for trying to get a sound that I couldn't control. And that's what came out, which was pretty great.
that price figure, I mean, that is quintessential Al, though. It's just that relentless thing. I mean, we have mentioned this once or twice before, but to have that now to work with rather than always starting from scratch, it must be a great sort of bed for ideas to spark off something, rather than having to go back to the blank page every time.
Oh God, it's so much. It's like, I mean, you know, it's so much easier, right? Rather than having to start from nothing for 12, 13, 14, 15 songs, and just, you know, okay, here we go again. This way, there's something there. There's something, even, you know, even the idea of the lyric flood and the idea of flood comes to me from the music. Like, you know, to me, that the, as I say, that the piece that Al created, the bass line and the piano has this incessant, unstoppable feel to it, and I think that really is what inspired. Okay, this sounds like a flood. Like, this sounds like something coming at you that you can't stop. And I think that's sort of where it came from. So it's great even to have that. Never mind a bass to write to, or a musical bass to write to, also to have the inspiration of a sound and go, okay, what does this bring out in me? So that happens a lot. It's really great. It's fun to have that.
Hard to build. I mean, again, we've talked about that a little bit already, but again, in the context, this is sort of moving on to the macro rather than the micro a little bit, isn't it?
Yeah. And again, this is a piece that Al, the music, the bass line and the drums and the grooves, all Al, and I wrote pretty much to what he gave me. And again, this, talking about being inspired by a sound and a groove, like this does that as well. It's got a nice kind of, I want to say fun, but it does have a fun feel to it. It's a groove song, right? So, the idea was to come up with something from my end, something a bit kind of catchy-ish, So, like, the hard to build, he's a great sort of tagline. I thought, that sort of feeds into what he gave me. Yeah, so it's just one of those songs that, it's sort of a classic Al song where it's his 70s groove thing happening. I really love it. And lyrically, yeah, it's about sort of being, trying to appreciate what one has, how hard it is to build things, whether it be a life or a democracy or a relationship, and how easy it is to break it. It's just so easy to be, easy to be negative, hard to be positive, so. That's sort of what it's about.
The bit about all the future kings and queens looking like the hero of their show. that is the change that's happened, isn't it, the last sort of 10 or 15 years?
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's just everybody being the stars of their own little movie and not giving a shit about the person next to them. They are the king or the queen, and everybody else is irrelevant. It's like, no, it doesn't work like that, people.
I mean, if you want to apply that to politics, I mean, it does fit in with some of these ludicrous figures like, Marjorie Taylor Greene or people like that. And you think back, I don't know, what was it, 15 years, Michelle Obama, when they go low, we go high. I don't see anybody going high anymore.
No, it doesn't work. It doesn't work. I mean, it's amazing. It just doesn't work anymore. You sort of can't use intelligence or honesty or being straight with people anymore. Let's just be like, this is what it is. We all know it is this, but you can't say it's this because for some weird reason we have to couch everything in other terms or undermine what's in front of you rather than disagreeing with it and putting and proposing something which you think is better. It's got to be destruction, right? You got to break it. You got to break everything else in front of you in order for your idea because you want your idea to be the only one standing rather than, okay, well, let's have these two ideas compete with one another. No, you got to destroy the other one. And then, so it's a very weird, civilizations don't last like that. So we'll see.
The guitar solo, we have touched on it before, but I mean, it is a great solo. That's a big mistake.
I love it. I love it. From the my go-to for guitar solos is kind of to go off rhythm, right? Sort of to create a feel and create an emotion, but not necessary, and try and not really do what's predictable. So this one, to me has it occasionally sits in the groove and then breaks away from it, and occasionally will. There'll be a little melody in there, and then we'll break away from that. And then I love even the way some of the effects I was using kick in and out, and it just came off really good. I just loved it. This solo to me is one of my faves.
It's kind of enraged as well.
Yeah, it's got that. It's also got there's a bit of anger in it, but there's also a certain amount of playfulness in it, and which I like too. So it's got a little bit of everything.
I've got no scientific basis for this. I haven't checked, but it always seems to me that your backing vocals are more prominent when it's something that's really got you riled. It's same on Knives, and I think it's on, you know, on one or two previous records. I don't know whether that's true or not.
I don't know either. Yeah, you'll have to get the data on that.
we'll come back to Margot in a bit, but I don't think she's ever sung better than she does on this record.
I agree. I think part of that was because she was able to spend, like, Margot takes a lot of time to get to figure out songs usually, and to find her place in them. It's kind of a strange thing. I'm bringing her words and melodies that, and then she has to sort of figure out many different sides to them, and keys even. We obviously will work the keys of the songs around her, but still, there's this sort of exploratory period. And with this record, because we were able to sit, the two of us, and for a couple of months, really, while I was writing and her to sing them and listen to them, just guitar and her vocal, she was able to be on top of the whole process, right? So she was first in. Usually she's last in. We'll create the track and then she'll have to figure out how to sing to it. Now she was sort of getting her vocal in. I mean, she would get her vocal in there, and we could build around the vocal sometimes. So it kind of was a good way to do it. And it also gave her, if a song changed completely as far as how we were presenting it, well, she had a starting point. She could say, okay, well, this vocal I'm doing now doesn't work anymore, but I understand the song and I understand, the approach that it should have, and I understand what it means even. Therefore, I can go at it. It was easier for her to sort of change, quickly. So it worked out really well, and I think the proof is there. All these songs, I think she really got.
I don't know what you got, but I got a bag full of heartache and yarn. Think of them almost every day, while pulling seams and keeping them all at bay. I don't know what you got, but I got a life full of regrets and dreams.
Circe and Penelope, I mean, that's, people will listen to that and think that's very much the Caution Horses kind of Cowboy Junkies, I suppose, in a way.
I guess so. You mean the musically? And yeah, I mean, it's a waltz and it's got a fiddle and it's a ukulele, but it could be a mandolin, So it is. I guess it is a fallback to that era of the band. I don't want to lose complete that touch with that era. Obviously live we don't. We do play a lot of songs from that era, so it's fine. But I love a waltz. Like, I love writing to a waltz. It's one of my favorite rhythms to write to, and there's a waltz just it exudes a sort of a timelessness and beauty. You know, I really I think they're really beautiful waltz tempos. So I like writing to them. So I guess I try not to, there are a few waltzes we've done that we sort of fooled with and then screwed, you know, kind of juxtaposed nastiness into them. But a song like this, I just wanted it to be it's a really beautiful little conversation between these two mythical people and two archetypes, really. And I really love the song, and Margot puts it across great.
I mean, I guess that goes back to what you were saying at the start about, you know, having written 20 albums or whatever it is, you kind of second guess yourself and you think, oh, well, we've done that before. But just because you've done it before doesn't mean you shouldn't do it again.
Exactly, especially if you do it so well. Like, there's not a whole lot of bands out there in the rock alternative world that are doing waltzes, you know. So, you know, I think it's okay for us to be doing them.
I mean, I like the the story, the weaving the shroud and then unpicking it at night. In a sense, I guess that ties in with your dad's dementia, because you have your day. And then your memory unpicks it all that night, and you start again the following morning. Right?
That's interesting. I never put that together, but that works. I'll use that in the future. That's good, Dave. Thanks.
Yeah, that's okay. No problem.
Yeah, and then you have Cersei, who she's trying to get through her day with potions and charms and herbs and stuff. So I think that works too, because that's part of it too. You know, as you get older, that's part of the routine. You're trying to figure out what medications work and don't work and what you're supposed to drink. So I'm using all that. That's good.
it's just a perfect example of one of the facets of the band that you do really, really well. You know, I mean, you can see this being a really great stage song in the acoustic set.
I miss them almost every day. I taste them with every breath I take. While gathering herbs for my potions and charms. But I don't really care. Enjoy the what ifs and the could have beens. Circe and Penelope.
Yeah, for sure. I think it'll this one will be with us for a while, because I think Margot really loves it, so she'll want to sing it for a long time. And I just as I say, I love a waltz.
I love the last line.
I don't know what you got, but I got a chest full of beauty and dirt.
Yeah, me too. I think it takes people by surprise. So. But again, that goes into, you know, the such ferocious beauty side of it, right? I mean, you're how often do you have those two that you know, it's more regular than not where you have those two sides, right? Like, I love this, but I also hate this, you know, it's like there's the two, the yin and the yang of it. So that was sort of that idea.
We're not quite halfway through the record, but we'll pause there for the moment. We'll be back with part two of this conversation with Michael Timmins shortly. And don't fret, we'll be talking to Alan Anton about the album soon too. If you haven't already ordered your copy of Such Ferocious Beauty, you can get it from all the usual outlets, including at cowboyjunkies.com. There are plenty of new Junkies shows coming up across North America over the rest of the year. Keep checking the website for more news of them, and remember, if in doubt, go to the show. Please subscribe to the podcast, like it, share it, add reviews, and do all the social media things that alert the world. Thank you so much for your support. We all really appreciate it. If you're a Spotify user, you can follow our growing podcast playlist, and all the details of that and everything else is in the show notes. We'll see you soon with part two of this conversation.
I woke up this morning, didn't know who I was. Looked at the room, didn't know where I was. Here they come around asking, please tell them in passing, this is what I lost. Here they come around asking, please tell them in passing, this is what I lost. This is what I lost. I woke up this morning,